everybody. My name is Deborah Vining. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful to be here. This has been such a phenomenal weekend. And I want to thank Lee and the committee for inviting me and my hostess, Ann, and the speakers. Oh, my gosh. Everyone is hit out of the park. I always loved hearing Sharon. She always reminds me of Sharon Tate. She's so beautiful. And, well, you said other people had said that too. And Beth is my new sponsor. She became my sponsor almost 2 years ago. And so this has been extra special to be with her on for this weekend. And Angie, when I was here with Angie's husband Chip was with my husband Steve in Jacksonville. And they were actually taking a meeting to a member of the fellowship who had had surgery. And so carrying the message all over the place. And so my sobriety date is September 10th of 1988, and my home group is the Fiesta group in Jacksonville, and I love the Florida that's still representing. Woo! We've had quite a few people. It's just been so phenomenal. I have not slept since I got here. With every speaker, I would get more and more nervous and self-consumed. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like, I don't know when that will leave. In some areas, I'm able to surrender it more easily, but I sometimes think that these are the ways that I have to press in even deeper, because there's such an awareness that I can't do this. Of myself, I cannot do that. And so I just want to thank everybody for making a 12-step call on me. And, I need you desperately. Now, Amanda's been so good with the jokes. I've got a joke for you. Okay. A woman in a hot air balloon realized she was lost. She saw a person on the ground and yelled down to her, "Can you help me? I don't know where I am." The woman replied, "Sure, I'll help you. You are in a hot air balloon hovering 30 feet above the ground, between 40 and 41 degrees north latitude, and between 59 and 60 degrees west longitude." "Wow, you must be an AA sponsor," said the woman in the balloon. "I am," said the woman, "but what gave me away?" "Well," answered the balloonist, "everything you told me is technically right, but I am still lost." "Frankly, you've not been much help at all, and you might have even delayed my trip." "You must be an AA sponsee," replied the woman. The woman in the balloon was amazed and said, "I am, but how did you know?" The woman on the ground said, "Well, you don't know where you are or where you're going. You have risen to where you are due to a lot of hot air. You're expecting other people to solve your problems. And the fact is that you are in exactly the same position you were in before we met. But somehow now it's my fault." I just love these weekends to have a fresh filling and practice principles and love on other alcoholics from all over the place. And as I was just kind of praying, I was jotting down some stuff this morning that I want this for me and I want this for you. That I've kind of had to learn the hard way that, yes, absolutely, God is good and AA works, without a doubt, without a doubt. But for me, it's not enough to want to change or desire to change or even wish to change. I have to make a decision for a deliberate, intentional effort to grow. You know, I always thought that I would just grow by aging. And I'm here to tell you, you can be old without a lick of growth. And, that I just thought it would happen. I didn't realize that it was going to require, you know, practicing these principles and doing it afraid and making mistakes and having a scare down my face and a scraped knee and a tear in my hose or whatever. And so sometimes I have to ask myself, you know, where do I want to be in 6 months or in a year in terms of enlarging my spiritual life? Because that's the point that we read at most every meeting. The point is to grow along. spiritual lines. And, you know, I know that that growth always requires change, but change doesn't always require growth. I can change jobs, cities, spouses, sponsors, home groups, and not grow a lick. I mean, sometimes I can even back up. So it has to be a very determined emphasis. And I guess the reason I wanted to kind of hammer on that a little bit with step 12 is the neon sign of practice. Practice. I mean, that has been, it's like, accept, surrender, practice. Accept, surrender, practice. That this isn't something that's just out here. This is for every single one of us to practice these principles in all our affairs, knowing that practice doesn't necessarily make perfect, but it certainly makes better. And so, so that's my desire. I had shared a little bit Saturday night. This is my mom had passed away when I was 14, and then when I came to you 2 decades later at 34, my sponsor 9 years later passed from the same thing. And when I was 19, I was already out of my first marriage. I got married when I was 18. There was a guy that had shown up at my church. He had long blonde hair. He was a drug dealer from Gainesville and everything I wanted in a husband. And so we got married at 18. And I was 18. He was older. And so when I was 19, my dad remarried. Now, as the oldest daughter, she wasn't my mother. I mean, my dad required that I be polite or courteous, but I telegraphed, "You're not my mom." Well, so she has been my stepmother, my mother, for 46 years, and she passed away February 14th of this year. And because of doing what Alcoholics Anonymous ask us to do, that these relationships, a deep healing came to me in terms of how I had been selfish and self-centered, alcoholic adolescent with my biological mother, that she was estranged from her biological daughter, and yet that relationship was able to meet both of our needs. And she passed February 14th, Valentine's Day, and I was just so grateful because I thought even that was kind of a divine appointment for her to be with the love of her life, which was my dad. And that's how I first came to love her, is she took such good care of my dad. And that's not who I am. That is absolutely not who I am without the personality change sufficient to recover. So and I'm kind of going to break out the step in three sections. Having had a personality change sufficient to recover. Now, I did not think that I needed a personality change. I knew you needed a personality change. In fact, I would pass a polygraph that it's other people's personalities that kept me in a state of distress and fear and angst. And over in the steps, they stress that finally, I start identifying the problem, coming to believe there's a solution, making a decision to seek that solution. Then I start looking at my inventory, not yours. My wrongs, not yours. My defects and shortcomings, not yours. Look at the people that I've harmed. Cleaning up my side of the street with 9. Our wrongs, my wrongs in 10. Improving my conscious contact in 11, and practicing principles in my affair, that is focused with not on you've got to change for me to be okay, because that kept me drunk and alone. So I had to go through the pains of growing up with all of you in terms of practicing these principles to have a personality change sufficient to recover. And these are things that spiritually mature people do. I mean, it's just nothing I'd ever done. I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, to, as I mentioned, a loving family. It was my mom, my dad, my sister, and myself. If my sister was here today, she would identify as an alcoholic. For most of the last 50 years, she's been treating her alcoholism with alcohol, and she would identify that as such. By the grace of God, for the last 30 years, I've been treating with Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm convinced that my alcoholism demands to be treated. It's going to get treated. I'm going to treat it with alcohol or Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's kind of like that question posed last night of God is either everything or nothing. Because when I'm treating my alcoholism with alcohol, he really is nothing. I mean, he's not nothing, but my desire for him, my relationship with him just disappears. And so I had made decisions all through my life as an insecure kid, making hundreds of insecure decisions, some of which I still pay for today. And I've had to come to find that, you know, I love my husband. He's a great husband. We've been married almost 30 years. But he can't make me secure any more than other people can make me secure, or power or prestige or comfort or any of this stuff. And so this has been like a profound personality change for me, because I was convinced if I had the right guy, if I had the right car, if I had the right weight, if I was in the right place, that then I would be okay. I left that first marriage. I didn't even get a divorce. I just split. That's just the way I was. And I left, and I met a guy who'd just been hired to convert the Big Daddy's lounges in L.A. and Orange County to discotheques. So now we're in the disco era. And so we take off and move to L.A. And, you know, I thought I'd arrived. I mean, I got dumped him, and I met someone else, and this guy was kind of a fringe. He wasn't a fringe celebrity. He was a con artist. But his last name was Con. I'm not kidding. But to me, it was like we were at Malibu and Rodeo Drive and go to Hefner's and all these things I'd heard about. That just like, oh my gosh, that if I could live that life, then I would be okay. Well, a year and a half into that, when he kicked me to the curb, dumped me, I had no job, no self-esteem, no character, no friends. I holed up in a little apartment and gained a lot of weight, and I was afraid to answer the phone or go to the door. And I remember pulling up at convenience stores to buy alcohol or cigarettes, and I'd just be in my car and go, I was just terrified all the time. And I might have thought at that point, I've missed my mark, you know. I might need to look at this. But I would pass a polygraph for the next 2 decades, really, that the problem was these jerks I keep ending up with. That if I could be with the right person who would just take care of me. And so that's why the concept of turning my will and my life over to the care of my higher power, the God of my understanding, because when I kept turning it over to the care of non-higher powers, I got darker and darker and more pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I feel like so much of the things that have happened to me in terms of the steps, and I love how it talks about in the 12 and 12 that we have a tendency, I have a tendency, to either dominate and try to control or try to make the world and everybody in it like a protective parent. And my life would be a pendulum between those two things. That I would either be telling you what to do, telling you how to do it, and then in the same breath, take care of me, I'm just a child or whatever. And I've come to realize that that's kind of like I either wanted to play God or make you God. And both of them are delusional. And so the personality change sufficient to recover is starting to get stuff in order. Now, I guess the first thing I'm going to do is make a case for the need of a personality change. And I do love our literature, which, you know, I agree, it's a map and a mirror. It gives me the directions. I get to see myself. But it's also full of promises and death threats, right? So but we have to do these things or... But it tells us that a number of eminent psychologists and doctors made an exhaustive study of alcoholics. The doctors weren't trying to find how different we were from one another. They sought to find whatever personality traits, if any, these alcoholics had in common. They finally came up with a conclusion that shocked the AA members of that time. These distinguished men had the nerve to say that most of the alcoholics under investigation were still childish, emotionally sensitive, and grandiose. And I can even remember as a little kid, you know, walking to the bus stop. And if people were talking, I thought they were talking about me, or if they didn't give me attention, I was just always a grinched up, fearful, hypersensitive, quick to cry little kid. And so when I had my first drink at 14, I mean, my fears literally fell from me. And that I could be spontaneous and gregarious, and I got cuter, and I wasn't so self-consumed and terrified all the time. It also says that, and I just listed some of these things. This is from our literature. But driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, bombarded people with self-will and willpower to get my way, that I was almost always in collision with something or somebody, that I'd been egotistical and dishonest, frequently making others wish to retaliate, that I chose comfort over character, that I was controlling and blaming with a pattern of putting myself in a position to be hurt, that of myself I was a producer of confusion rather than harmony, that I'd been unteachable, I couldn't accept conditions as they were. I couldn't accept correction or direction. I wouldn't submit to any authority. I wasn't going to submit to the authority of my parents, to the police, to teachers, to employers. I just always had that in me. I was pretty sneaky about it. My sister was much more obvious about it. But that I was spiritually sick, inconsiderate, that I unjustifiably aroused jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness, that I turned my will and my life over to alcohol, drugs, and other people, and that definitely I had been addicted to approval. Now, that's just a short list of what our literature says, so can we agree I need a personality change? And this is something I just want to read real quick. Now, this is not part of our literature. This is from a spiritual leader. And when I read this, it was like, oh my gosh, that is me to a T. And it also applies to almost every woman I've had the pleasure to work with. Emotional needs can be every bit as acute as bodily requirements. The desire for love, acceptance, and a sense of safety are hardwired into human beings by God. These necessities are what cause us to seek out friendships, marriage, and ultimately a relationship with God. And at the root of all our heart needs is the longing to feel valued. Without a solid sense of self-worth, a person cannot fully receive love and acceptance. Nor can he feel safe and at rest. The uncertain person projects onto family and friends the God-sized job of proving his value. From them, he seeks constant verbal assurance and displays of their loyalty. The problem is that no human can be an inexhaustible emotional resource. Inevitably, basing worth on people's judgments and acts of love makes for a yo-yo-like self-image. It's down, it's up, it's down again. Besides, no one can build an adequate collection of good opinions to substitute for God's devotion. God desires to be our unlimited emotional resource. In fact, if our self-worth is based on anything but Him, then it's unstable. And of course, it goes on to say the best source of emotional stability is God Himself, which I was desperate for emotional stability. I mean, I could so relate to some of the other speakers. It's like I can look at my husband and say, I love him so much. He is so handsome. He's a good husband. I've about had it with him. He's driving me crazy. In fact, when we were coming here, I packed a lot of stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, he's going to say, what did you do, pack bricks? Because that's what he always says. I said, he better not say, what did you do, pack bricks? And then I thought, I hope he says, what did you do, pack bricks? And of course, he did not disappoint, but it's like, oh my gosh, to be able to have that sort of emotional stability where I'm not already deciding how I'm going to get disturbed or how my feelings are going to be hurt or how I'm in some big nerve ending. And I agree with our other speakers too. I'm not trying to present alcoholism as an emotional problem. I mean, if you're not allergic to alcohol, you're not an alcoholic. The physical component is what connects us in this way, But I had to recognize the need for a personality change sufficient to recover. So in terms of carrying this message to other alcoholics, I actually came to Alcoholics Anonymous because somebody was willing to 12-step me. I was working at a radio station. Now, there was a time... incidentally, when I was in L.A. and I got dumped, and then I met another guy and moved to Pittsburgh, and And in Pittsburgh, I did something I'd not done to this point. I got a job. I thought I should just be supported or whatever, but I started selling radio advertising and was doing well. I mean, they basically handed me a phone book and I started calling on businesses. And there was a time I had a lot of opportunities in that industry. But as my alcoholism progressed, I'd get to the office first thing in the morning, my nose would be running, I could smell alcohol through my skin, I'd put stuff on people's desks so I can get the heck out of Dodge before people come in, and so when I met this guy, I was at the tail end. In fact, I'd been hired to participate in a new station in Orlando, and I was hired based on my previous income, and he made the awful mistake of giving me a guarantee based on what I'd done in the past. But now my alcoholism has progressed, so I'm just a deranged prima donna, in effect, and just undermining everything. And so I got back to Jacksonville. I'd left Jacksonville because my second ex-husband was trying to kill me. And, but at some point I liked drinking at really nice places and, Baccarat Crystal or whatever. And now I like the honky-tonk juke joints. In order for me to be the queen bee, it had to get darker and darker and darker. And so about this time I met my second ex-husband, who was an alcoholic and a criminal. And not like a weenie criminal, like a real criminal. He got charged with 9 felonies the first 90 days of our marriage, and one of them was attempted murder. And he was guilty. He wasn't found guilty, but he was guilty. But that was the progression of my disease. And, this was just the way I lived. Now, when I had been in L.A., I had come to once that I had a cut all the way through my lip, and I couldn't figure out what happened. I mean, it was bizarre. It didn't touch my lip. It was all the way through the top. And I thought, well, maybe there's a broken plate in the kitchen. Maybe it went face down on the plate. Or maybe I had like some weird seizure and bit my lip. Or maybe my then husband hit me in the mouth. I mean, my then boyfriend hit me in the mouth. None of those options terrified me because the alcoholic life had become the normal life. And so now, the second ex-husband, I was a battered wife. And unlike some of our other speakers, I was verbally abusive, but I definitely was not the physical abusive one. And I kept going back. My self-esteem, my sense of worth was just gone. And so anyway, I'd gotten out of that horrible situation, left town, came back to Jacksonville, still my alcoholism is progressing, and anytime I couldn't make it back to the office to turn in a production order or to pick up a tape or anything along those lines, there was a guy at work who was my go-to guy. And I would call him and say, hey, can you pick it up? Can you turn in the order? And one day he told me that he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was to take me to my first meeting. Now, I ended up picking up 3 white chips, but I don't consider that I relapsed because I was drinking the whole time. But but when I picked up my 10-year chip, he picked up a white chip, and I've not seen him since. I was so grateful he was willing to break his anonymity. And I love what Bill Wilson says, yes, it's a program of attraction, but it's hard to be attractive if you're invisible. And so I always want to be willing. Another thing that was really interesting, when I came to AA, my husband, Steve, lived down the street from me. We didn't know each other. He was working and going to meetings, and I was pretty much looking out the blinds and hallucinating. And I can't remember where I was going with that. Oh, my God. I know I'll probably circle back around. Something answers. Okay. Well, I'm still selling radio. Oh, I know what it was. Okay, here it is. All right, so if people said to me, how did you meet your husband? I could say, well, we were neighbors. He lived 4 houses down, and he did. Or I can say we have mutual friends, friends of Bill W. Both of those statements would be true. But one day I was calling on one of my biggest accounts, and the receptionist asked me where I met my husband. And for some reason, I just said I met him in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, well, that was weird. I mean, that would normally be my response. And a week later, she showed up at my home group with her face all bashed in. And so we just want to listen to that still small voice, that prompting in our spirit to always be responsible in that way. My sister, I'm not sure what her situation is right now. I love her very, very much. We're the only surviving blood relatives. But it's a tough deal. It's a very, very tough deal. Part of the benefits, or I guess the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, that my stepmother made me the executor and the sole trustee, and so her inheritance has gone into trust. And so as much as I've been going to Al-Anon to not be involved in all of that, at this point it's just going to add a different dimension. So I'm just going to need every bit of this that I can do. You know, I wanted to read this from Language of the Heart that I absolutely love. Why at this particular point in history has God chosen to communicate his healing grace to so many of us? Every aspect of this global unfolding can be related to a single crucial word. The word is communication among ourselves, with the world around us, and with God. From the beginning, communication in AA has been no ordinary transmission of helpful ideas and attitudes. Because of our kinship and suffering, and because our common means of deliverance are effective for ourselves only when constantly carried to others, our channel of contact has always been charged with the language of the heart. All true communication must be founded on mutual need. We saw that each sponsor would have to admit humbly his own needs as clearly as those of his prospect. And I think that's such an important thing for me to realize in sponsorship, that I need sponsees. You know, I have got to be sponsoring people. I mean, that's where I get to practice the principles, to try to be right size, to surrender self. I need it desperately. And I want to tell a story, which she's asked me to bring her the CD, so she's going to hear this. But I'm sponsoring a little new gal. She's got maybe 35 days now. And, I mean, like me, obsessed. And, you know, trying to go to any length to stay sober and getting to tons of meeting for the fellowship. And we started working the steps and we've got a good game plan in place. Well, she had called me yesterday, I think it was. And I called her back, and she was talking about that she was really obsessed. She was freaking about work. She was freaking out about this, and, you know, going on. And I'm listening, and I'm relating to it. And I said, I haven't had any sleep in 2 days, and I'm getting ready to speak, and you should have heard the other speakers. I'm going to lose my mind. This is going to be awful. And she said, Deborah, you'll do great. You're a MILF. She's 28. You're a MILF and you're a rock star. So, I said to her, I said, okay, well then what I'm going to say to you is that you're a rock star and everybody wants to bang you. I mean, that was like, no, that was no comfort at all. But then we both burst out laughing. It was like, oh my gosh, we're both obsessed, we're both into self-reliance, we're both projecting, we're both interested in superficial stuff, we're all about me, 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 I. And so at that point, we had a mutual need, let there be no mistake. And so much of this is just not taking ourselves so seriously and just laughing and trying to take it easy. Because I am by nature a very serious person. And I can get very grinched up and get really in my head. And, you know, I've had to learn the hard way in Alcoholics Anonymous to just really learn for ways to identify. You know, my nature before I came here was to compare and to compete. And that creates unhealthy competition. But when we identify, then that's fellowship and community, and I desperately need that. Well, one thing I thought I was going to do that was a little different is all the speakers have done such a great job sharing their experience on the steps and talking about the principles, which of course are the steps. But this is why I want to stress the practical program of action, that is not just something out here, that these are really things that every single day that I can practice, you can practice, this and that. And of course, we've heard so much this weekend about the principle of, you know, love and service. A principle is an essential truth upon which other truths are based. A rule by which a person chooses to govern his conduct. So he kind of talked about having had a personality change sufficient to recover, which that's guaranteed if you work the 12 steps, that you will have a personality change sufficient to recover. We've all had different experiences along the way, probably, but we touched on that. I shared a little bit about working with others. My first sponsor was a man. His name was Pappy. He started the club where my home group is, and I was so obsessed with drinking that I was there 3, 4, 5 times a day. And every time a new woman came in, he would bring her over to me. So even if I had 8 days, I could share with somebody how I didn't drink for 8 days. Here's a meeting. Here's a when and where. Let me show you where the restroom is. Let me introduce you around. Let me get you some ladies' numbers. Let me get you some literature. Let me get you a big book. And that was so priceless because I'm equally convinced of today, just like this little conversation over the weekend, that nothing gets me out of my head faster than working with a new woman. For 1 second, I'm not thinking about myself. And then I'd gone to a women's meeting, and I heard a woman share, and I said, it's really hard for me to talk to women. And I'd been an untrustworthy woman. You know, my mom had passed early on. And she said, that's all right. You can practice on me. And she became my first female sponsor and took me through the steps. And then she moved to California. Then my next sponsor, I had just heard about her. I had not met her. I live in town. She lives at the beach. And I went and asked her to be my sponsor. And she said, you know, I can't stand a whiner. Okay. And what happened then, and I shared about this briefly last night, when I was 12 seconds sober, my husband was 12 years sober, we started a relationship. And it's one of those things where he'd sit on one side of the room, I'd sit on the other side of the room, there'd be sparks going across the room, and we're like sneaking and the whole thing, and I don't recommend it, I'm not being glib. Frequently one or more can relapse, but this is what happened. It's not shocking because I always gravitated to a relationship. And right after we got married, he said, I don't know what to be married. He wasn't wearing a wedding ring. I didn't know what he was doing. It was just a very, very dark time. You know, here I am in my third marriage. You know, it's gone south. I have no idea how to make this work. And my sponsor said to me, which I swear, it's a miracle I even heard it. She said, Deborah, to run is not an option. You made a commitment in sobriety. You will grow along spiritual lines. You will bloom where you are planted, and you will grow up with this guy or a header just like him. And my track record confirmed that I would switch to here and switch to here and switch to here. And so what that required me to do is to hunker down to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to start doing the deal and not just, you know, going through the motions, because I was in so much emotional pain. I would just, you know, skid into the room like, ooh, just to keep my mouth shut, because I was just, I believe it's the only way that I could have started practicing turning my will and my life over to someone other than, you know, everybody else's opinion. I was so addicted to approval. Well, and then she passed away 9 years later. And then I got her sponsor, who's passed away, and then I had another sponsor, and then now I've gotten Beth. So I've always had a sponsor. I'm very excited about this new relationship. One of the first things I started doing when Beth became my sponsor is taking my sponsees for 13 week. For the first 13 chapters, the appendixes and everything for the big book. And that's been really helpful, keeping us all in the books, and they go do it with theirs. Beth has an advance that some of us go to, and then we try to do it with our sponsees. So I always think of it, if I'm sponsoring somebody who's not sponsoring others, it's like you sow seed and they eat the seed. And so you love it when everybody just keeps passing it on. And in fact, we had a little breakfast event, and there was one of seven generations down from Beth, which was just so amazing. So we've talked a little bit about working with others. And so now about this thing about practicing these principles in all our affairs. An essential truth upon which other truths are based. A rule by which a person chooses to govern his conduct. So love and service, give it away to keep it, grow or go, trust God, clean house, help others. I believe that for me, if there's not an intentional growth, I'll have 1 year of sobriety 30 times instead of 30 years of sobriety. And that's my desire. We have little pink cards that we hand out to new women. Welcome. Here's my name. Here's my number. Keep coming back and try and get their numbers as well. But I also know that, that I can unwork the steps, and I also get to see tragically, other people work the steps. So it's like a little checklist. You know, here I've had the personality change. Here I'm working with others. I'm trying to practice these principles, but it is easy to rest on your laurels. Am I letting others, these would be the checklist for me on step 12. Am I letting others handle 12-step calls? Am I going up to newcomers and welcoming them, getting their numbers and calling them, giving them my number? Am I just saying yes to service when it's convenient? My relapse has already started if my sobriety is based on convenience. Do I see myself as an AA expert, a celebrity, an authority? Have I become an AA bouncer? I have. I remember going to my sponsor once, and she said, Deborah, you are not the AA monitor. You are not the AA bouncer. So we got to get back right size, another bozo on the bus. And then in step 11, you know, this whole thing in terms of spiritual growth has been so vast and fabulous. I did in fairly early sobriety. I'm praying, I'm desperate, I'm obsessed, and I'm just seeking. And I'd gone to a meeting at a beach, and a guy had said that whenever he was afraid, he would say a prayer. And it was, Abba, I believe. Abba, I believe. I didn't know that then, but that's Hebrew for father, for daddy. And so I went to work the next day, and I'm freaking out and obsessing. And it's like, oh, my gosh, what was that guy's prayer? And all I could remember was, yabba dabba do. All day long, I said, yabba dabba do. And I didn't drink, and I didn't run. And I got to experience that God met me right where I was. And over and over and over again, I see that in your lives as well as mine. And it's interesting, one of the things I was going to say today is if you know how to worry, you know how to meditate, except for the fact I do know how to meditate and I've been worried all weekend. But that, I guess it needs like advanced meditation, but... Am I slacking off of prayer meditation? Have I stopped listening to that intuitive thought or inspiration? You know, my heart was so calloused and hard, I couldn't even hear anything. And I do all this work to get softened and listen, and I can unwork that. Have I stopped paying attention in meetings? Am I texting, talking, not listening, being disruptive? I think every meeting can be a 11-step practice. We open in prayer. We close in prayer. We listen to other people share their experience, strength, and hope, how they're trying to grow along spiritual lines. Am I being disruptive? Have I stopped trying to grow along spiritual lines, stopped enlarging my spiritual life, stopped trying to improve my conscious contact? When I tell someone I'll pray for them, do I really do it? I mean, that's a checklist for me that is like, girl, are you doing what you're saying, or are you just doing lip service? Am I just growing enough not to drink, which is huge, don't get me wrong, or am I deliberately on purpose trying to be a channel of God's peace? How's my emotional balance? You know, that's a big promise. And the sponsor that I told you about that saved my marriage and was so pivotal in really showing me demanding, hard talk, strong accountability, that had passed away when the same thing that had taken my mom. In 97, Steve and I were building our dream home. We prayed about it. We're building a home on the St. John's River. It's answered prayer. My husband used to be homeless, living in Santa Barbara, underneath an avocado tree. And so for us to be able to do something like this was just amazing. And we were so grateful for it. But even though we'd done due diligence, our builder went bankrupt and misappropriated a bunch of money. And so we hired the foreman on the job, so I became kind of the overseer. Well, you heard, I sold radio advertising. I'm an alcoholic party girl. I mean, I got no idea how to build a house. So every morning, I'm like on my knees, you know, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. And seven-step prayer and serenity prayer and all these prayers just to be able to get up, suit up, and show up. You know, show up in the shower, show up in my shoes, take the action, trust God with the results. You know, I do the footwork, he handles the outcome. And things are going pretty well. I mean, the house is moving along. It's amazing. And some months into the job, I'm on the phone with my sponsor, and I said, these people are incompetent. They're a bunch of idiots. I don't know what's wrong with them. And there was a pause at the end of the phone, and she said, Deborah, I think you're suffering from self-importance. And I thought, I need to get a sponsor who knows how to build a house. It was that strong in my mind. But, you know, the 12 and 12 talks about that there's four disciplines that we must develop. One is self-restraint. Two is an honest analysis of what went down, which a lot of my calls were, he said this, and I said this, and she said this, and I said this, because I don't know how I was at fault or started the ball rolling. A willingness to forgive when the fault is elsewhere, and a willingness to admit when the fault is mine. But I'd practiced enough self-restraint by that point with tons of written 10 steps, which I'm a big advocate of also, has always been helpful to me, that I kept my mouth shut, that I practiced self-restraint. And as soon as I got off the phone, I thought, she is 100% right. And I'm so grateful that I've got a woman who's willing to speak truth into my life. And I'm equally grateful that I could hear it. But that's how fast I got in the weeds. I go to a meeting every day, work with others, active in my home group, service commitments, these sort of things, and yet I was convinced the problem was my sponsor couldn't build a house. You know, it's just crazy. So the 10th step, how is my open-mindedness and perseverance? Have I stopped taking personal inventory? When was the last time I did a written inventory with my sponsor or with anybody? Am I using my sponsor or is it just a sponsor in name? Am I being accountable? Am I settling for less? And I always just remind myself, I better check myself before I wreck myself because I can get in the weeds really fast. And then in steps 8 and 9, you know, yes, the principles are the steps, but our literature references lots of other principles within those steps, too, as well as things that I've experienced. As I told you, when my marriage was in the weeds big time, I guess I was 36 months sober because I remember that's what I was going to say to the person. but my husband was doing the steps at a local place in our area. And he came home one night and he said, there was a woman there that hugged me and it wasn't an AA hug. So now I'm obsessed. It's like, okay, who is this? And I'm not sure who it is. And then I research and I find out who it is. And, you know, I will say, in my defense, she was crazy. But she started calling her at the office and showing up at our home group, and our marriage was already really fragile. And it's like, oh, my gosh. And so the first thing that I looked at in terms of 6 and 7, well, first of all, I called my sponsor. And I said, I got to whip her ass. Now, I'm much more Billy to bed talk it than Rhea, but I did talk that way. And she said, well, we'll do it together, but it'll be tomorrow. And then I'm thinking, I'm going to go to her work. I'm going to humiliate her. I mean, I'm so threatened now. I mean, this is like, and I, you know, I'm licensed to carry a concealed weapon. I thought she should see that. And all this is in my head. All this is going on in my head. And so now I get my posse and my peeps. We're all talking about this person. And so clearly there was jealousy. It's like, oh my gosh, you are so jealous. And then I thought, well, yeah, it's jealous too, but it's pride. It's like, who does she think she is? Doesn't she know who I am? I mean, this was now the stuff that's happening. And so I'm trying to surrender it, but I'm obsessed. And this is why I talk about so many safety nets in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I wasn't totally willing to surrender. I mean, I didn't go to her office. I didn't do any of this stuff. But it's still here, big time. But I thought about the first tradition. It's like, oh my gosh, our common welfare comes first. You're disrupting multiple groups with this foolishness. And, you know, kind of like what I shared Saturday night, that, you know, I do believe my higher power is merciful. That's an important thing for me to believe because there's a lot of bad things that happen in our lives, right? And so I have to believe that if he allowed it, that he's going to work it to the good. And so I was able to look at how many times when I would be at the bars, if a man said, my wife doesn't understand me, or we're separated, that translated to that he's available. I didn't care about marriages. I didn't care about families. I didn't care about children. So as painful as that situation was, it was months. I mean, it wasn't like some quick thing. As painful as that was, yes, on my fourth step, I listed that I'd been unfaithful, that I'd done these things. But I hadn't received the full impact of, oh my gosh, what does that feel like? And so it was a further awareness that it doesn't end at the tip of my nose. I had a similar situation along the same lines. My husband was traveling with business, and I was at an AA event, and I was walking across the banquet room, and all of a sudden, self-conscious. I mean, self-conscious is like a huge thing. If I'm not doing six and seven, it's like this, baby, do I look nice? Baby, do I look as nice as I used to look? Baby, do I look nicer than her? It's like, shut up! But I'm walking across the room and I feel self-conscious. So I see an elderly member of my home group and he's like, hey, how are you? And I'm falling all over him. And then I look down and see his wife, who's not an Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's like, what's going on? I mean, she didn't say any of that, but I saw her facial expression. So I just want to continue to be aware of these sort of things. So that was up close and personal on that justice of harms in step eight. And I'd be diligent in financial reparations, child support, dodging my creditors, new debt, new bankruptcies. Am I continuing with spiritual amends, emotional amends? Am I continuing to take responsibility for my actions? Have I started focusing on the wrongs done to me? How's my forgiveness? Is unforgiveness creeping back in? And I can have that happen. I'll feel like something's all handled, and then I'll see the person, or something will trigger it, and I've got to pray again for that forgiveness. My first husband, I told you that was a drug dealer from Gainesville, he went on to live a productive life. So I think that part of the problem could have been me, but I never talked to him. I just left. I moved to LA. And so they had to track me down to get a divorce. And so they finally found me in California. I got a divorce, and my sponsor was adamant. All these men, Deborah, don't go by, ask about, ride by, check up on, and praise God they didn't have social media back then. So I had no dealings with him. Well, my husband's a big football fan, and we share a box with a family where one of the people passed away. And so I called. They wanted to make a donation to a certain charity. And I called, and my first ex-husband answered the phone. And it was right after my father had passed, so there'd been a thing in the paper and this and that, and we were both like, oh my gosh. And I told him I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wish that I would have been part of the solution, that, you know, I felt horrible about everything went down. And he said, Deborah, my wife and I have been praying for you for 25 years. Now, this was when I was 20 years sober. So I've been told, don't go around, ask about or whatever, but God will put these situations in front of us. He said, my wife and I have been praying for you, because I was 17 when I met him. And he felt awful about the bad influence he'd been in my life. And then he said, do you mind if I pray? And I said, no, I got on my knees, and he said a prayer on the phone. I mean, it's just amazing that we stay available, how these steps continue to, that's why it's not a drag. That's why it's not a drag for self-awareness, growing, self-examination, you know, admitting our faults, doing it promptly. You know, it's exciting and it's green and it's fresh. You know, how's my willingness and humility? Am I settling for just in 6 and 7? Am I settling for just what will get me by, or am I striving for a God-determined objective? You know, not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. Am I willing to not say, buy, or do something just because I can? Just because I can doesn't mean that I should. And I'm a big believer that 6 and 7, it's like with men, it's like you need to grow some. And with women, you got to put on your big girl panties and come sit at the adult table. Because these things are very, other people may not see it that much. Like, I cannot do it for a long time before it starts showing. Kind of like my alcoholism, it's the progression. But this is just a situation of real, continuing to be willing to surrender these defects. And 5, have I integrated my personalities, or am I back into leading a double life? How's my personal integrity? Am I compromising my beliefs, philosophies, morals, convictions? Do I have secrets? Am I back in the blame game? You take the me out of blame and it's blah, 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 blah. I'm convinced that my ego is not my amigo. All the steps try to deflate the ego, whereas I would constantly build it up. Even when I was selling radio advertising, I had a little cubicle full of plaques. I called it my ego wall. Even when I was drinking, I just innately knew that I was going to have to protect that, or I was going to have to surrender. You know, in 4, courage is fear that it says its prayers. Am I doing it afraid? The answer would be yes this weekend. I am doing it afraid this weekend. Am I harboring resentments, the number one offender that gets more alcoholics drunk than anything else? Am I insisting that if conditions and circumstances change, I'd be okay? Am I forgetting that alcohol was just a symptom, that I must see where I'm at fault, where I started the ball rolling? And then, of course, the faith in 3. And, you know, it's so easy to drift back into the bondage of self. And our literature says that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our problems. And yet, even today, if someone suggests that I'm selfish, I want to go, what? It's like, if it was the root of my problem then, it's the root of my problem now. Am I acting myself into a new way of thinking? I do believe that my sanity and faith starts in my feet, taking these actions. And then the obsessions of mine in 2. You know, I'm powerless if a bird flies over my head, but I don't have to let it build a nest in my hair. And so I've got to surrender these things. And I constantly want to drift into self-reliance and self-sufficiency. And when I catch myself grinched up, that's usually what's happening. And one of my favorite things in the big book is the question that if you're as alcoholic as we are, we believe there's no middle of the road solution. We had but 2 choices. One was to go to the bitter end, trying to blot out the consciousness of our intolerable situation, or 2, accept spiritual aid. I mean, that's pretty clear cut. I mean, this is such a simple program for complicated. And sometimes my sponsor would say, do you want to grow along spiritual lines? It's like, no, he needs to grow. He needs to grow. You You know, is my sobriety my number one priority? The most important thing I do every day is keep alcohol out of my system. I mean, I don't drink non-alcoholic beer. That's for alcoholics. I don't gargle with it. I don't eat it in desserts. If the waiter says the alcohol's cooked out, I think of it as a poison and not a beverage. If he says to me the strychnine and arsenic are cooked out, I don't want any. I mean, I don't want it. Because Katie barred the door. Once I ingest it, I can't guarantee what I'm going to do or when I'm going to quit. And so I can't get nonchalant about that. I've actually had two friends relapse as a result of that. So in closing, you know, there's no big shots in AA. There's no little shots in AA. One shot, we're all shot. And so that's the keeping it as the level playing field. And I heard a story about St. Francis, and he was gardening a beautiful garden. And a passerby came by and said, "Oh, St. Francis, this is such a beautiful garden. You must really pray for it to be so beautiful." And St. Francis said, "Yes, but every time I prayed, I picked up the rake." Now, I used to say I picked up the hoe, but I had to change that. But the point being is this is attainable for every single one of us. It's not some big thing out there that's kept from anything. It's practicing. Accept, surrender, practice. Accept, surrender, practice. And when I do that, I get a life beyond my wildest dreams, and I can tell you for sure that God is good and AA works. Thank you.
Thank you.